WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
The influential and controversial poet, playwright, and essayist Amiri Baraka died yesterday in his hometown of Newark, New Jersey. He was 79. Baraka, who was formerly known as Leroy Jones, was one of the leading black literary voices that emerged in the 60s. The political and social views that inspired his writing changed over the years. He started out as a young bohemian in Greenwich Village. He became more radical after the death of Malcolm X, and in his later years he saw himself as a Marxist. Baraka was a prominent cultural figure in the black nationalist movement of the 60s and 70s. His play The Dutchman, which won the Obie Award in 1964, gripped audiences with its explicit language and rage against the oppression of blacks in America. His writing about jazz and African-American culture, most notably blues people, Negro music in white America, was highly regarded. But his detractors accused him at various times of being racist, dangerously militant, homophobic, and anti-Semitic. His infamous 2002 poem about the September 11th attacks contained lines that suggested Israeli involvement in the attack on the World Trade Center. But as the New York Times' Margalit Fox wrote in Baraka's obituary, his champions and detractors agreed that at his finest, he was a powerful voice on the printed page, a riveting orator in person, and an enduring presence on the international literary scene whom, whether one loved him or hated him, was seldom possible to ignore. Terry Gross spoke to Amiri Baraka in 1986 about his formative years and the early part of his career, starting with his days as a young writer living in Greenwich Village and getting to know beat writers like Jack Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg.
I got to meet Ginsberg when I first came down to the Village because Howl had come out, you know, and I read it. And I think between Howl and James Baldwin's Notes of a Native Son, which I'd read the year before I got out of service, I thought those were the two books and the two authors that most turned me on at the time, Jimmy Baldwin and Allen Ginsberg. And so I wrote Ginsberg a letter. He was living in Paris. I wrote it on a piece of toilet paper, I guess to be dramatic, and asked him, you know, was he for real? You know, what is this? Is this for real or what is this? Just a game? And he wrote me back a letter. We started correspondence, you know. But I think in the main, it was there were a lot of people who were sincere, who were really trying to do something. I know we had come from different places, and because of that, we had different ideas, different aesthetics even. But I think in that circle, those people generally were fighting against the academic life, academic poetry of the 50s. Whether you're talking about Ginsberg and the Beats, or you're talking about Creeley and Olson and the Black Mountain School, or you're talking about Frank O'Hara and the New York School, as all these so-called schools, they were all, I think, aligned in a kind of united front against the dullness of the new critics and the dullness of the kind of poetry they're now trying to bring back.
Your play, The Dutchman, was produced off-Broadway in 1964, I think
64,
it was.
64, yeah.
And it won an Obie Award.
Yeah.
It was very controversial. People were, I think, very, very shocked at the sentiments being expressed,
yeah,
and also some of the language being used. And it's about a white woman who provokes and finally kills a black man. And at the time, you were married to a white woman.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you think that that affected the fact that this was a white woman and a black man and that you were married to a white woman? Had that affect the way you were seen and the way your play was received?
Well, I think actually, I can tell you, I can give you a for instance that will clarify. Now, when I wrote that play, Dutchman, which is really, you know, coming to consciousness, you know, what are the dangers to the middle class, but particularly the black middle class intellectual? That is the contradiction between seduction, which is, the, you know, the woman. I mean, because America advertises everything with the white woman. It could be peas or, you know, automobiles. But that is America, the seductive. So the intellectual is always first. There's the attempt at seduction. Come with me, you know, we're going to have a good time. You know, we're going to be together. But then if you refuse to do that, you are killed. That is, if you try to get off the train, if you say, no, I'm not going to do it. Now, black people, to me, it's obvious, you know, but I think intellectuals in general, it's also obvious. But I think the thing with me being married to a white woman at the time was that that made it okay, I think, in the kind of that sector of the establishment that deals with downtown. I think it made it okay. I think the next year, after I'd gotten a divorce and moved up to Harlem and we did the play up in Harlem, the play was termed racist, where in 1964 it won Obie Award, Best American Play. I don't know how a play can change just because you take the A train to present it, but it did.
When you left the bohemian life and living in Greenwich Village, you moved up to Harlem. And
Harlem,
that was,
yeah, yeah.
That was shortly after the assassination of Malcolm X.
Absolutely, yeah.
What did that move to you symbolize from going from the village up to Harlem?
Well, first of all, as young, you know, as intellectuals, we took that very seriously. I mean, the question of them of murdering Malcolm was not just a public figure being killed. It was like somebody that who we were sworn to be involved with and who had actually shaped our thinking. You know, I met Malcolm the month before he was killed. I mean, that was the second time I'd seen him. But I mean, I talked to Malcolm one night with a brother named Muhammad Babu from Tanzania all night. And, you know, that added to what Malcolm had, with the things he had been saying throughout his brief, you know, kind of appearance as a leader in America. I mean, it deeply changed my mind about America, made me see America in a way I had never, made me see myself in a way I had never. And then for them to kill him, for a lot of us, it represented a declaration of war. And I think, you know, the very idea that, you know, here you are down in Greenwich Village of fooling around, you know, I mean, I think I was at a book party that afternoon, you know. I mean, you know, just jiving around, although I guess I was as more active than most. But still, I mean, it was the thing is, but what does this mean? I mean, what is this as a commitment to, you know, the people themselves? And you see, I think one thing about the Dutchman thing itself that people never really understand is when that came out and I discovered that they were going to make me famous, it changed my whole personality, or it began to emphasize another aspect of personality, because until then I thought it was all right for me just to hang out and do anything I wanted to, because after all, you know, I didn't feel any sense of responsibility. I guess that's what it was. But I mean, the sense of responsibility, that is, if somebody's going to stand you up in front of a microphone or a TV, you see what I mean, and they say, what are you going to say? Then I have to remember what my grandmother told me about, you know, how they killed this little boy, you know, at 16 and cut off his genitals and stuffed them in his mouth and made all the little girls, black girls in town, come to watch that. And, you know, why she told me that when I was 10 years old, because she wanted me to know where I was. Then I have to remember that. I can't waste that. You know, I have to remember what happened to my grandfather, you know, how my mother and father struggled. I can't waste that. You know what I mean? I can't be a person who's now going to pretend that those things didn't really shape me in some kind of profound way, you see? So I have to say, I have to talk about those things. And to talk about those things in America is to be radical, just to talk about them.
After living in Harlem for a while, you moved to Newark, which is where you grew up. Did that feel like going home again?
Yeah, I mean, I was born in Newark. I left, you know, like you said, to go away to college. But I came back to Newark because I knew that that was where I began, and New York for me had, you know, had got old suddenly. There was nothing really I could do there. I mean, I could not see myself doing anything more in New York except, you know, laying back and cooling out. And so I went back really to Newark because I thought if any place I could get some kind of, you know, readdress with myself, if you would, you know.
Can you explain the reasons for your name change from Leroy Jones to Amiri Baraka?
Well, I'll tell you. It had to do with, why should I be an American? Why should I be identified? Well, even a Frenchman. But why should I be identified with that when I should do something to identify with my own real roots? And so the man who buried Malcolm X, this, you know, Muslim imam, priest, he, after I'd gotten beat up by the police during the rebellion, he came to me and he said, you don't need this American name. And I was susceptible to it at the time because God knows, I mean, I'd just gotten whipped near to death. And so he gave me an Arab name. He gave me the name Amir Barakat. But I didn't want an Arab name. And because we began to go into Kawaida, the kind of cultural value system organization that Ron Karinga was pushing on the West Coast, then I took that name in Swahiliized, or Bantuized, and changed it from Amir to Amiri, and from Barakat to Baraka to make it a Swahili name, the same kind of name you'd find in Tanzania, Uganda, or Kenya. And now, of course, I'm no longer in a cultural nationalist movement, but I'd be the only one in my family with an American name. All my kids, my five kids, you know, Obalaji, Raz, Shani, Midi, and Ahi. I mean, I'd be sapped to be walking around still Leroy.
Your life has changed many different times over the years. The circle you've traveled in has changed. Your location has changed. Your ideology has changed.
Yeah.
But one thing that's really remained a constant, I think, throughout your life is the power of music and the importance of it to you ever since you were young. Can you just explain the importance of music in your life?
Well, you grow up, you know, in a black community, you grow up surrounded by music. I mean, because African-American people, because they are repressed in so many areas, music has been one area, and athletics, as we see, that they've been allowed to develop to a certain extent. And so you grow up with that kind of context of all kinds of music. My parents loved Nat King Cole. We had all his albums before he started singing. I'm not talking about Nat King Cole the singer. I'm talking about when he had the Nat King Cole trio. They were great, you know, Count Basie fans. And then the blues, which is constant. I mean, Dinah Washington, Ruth Brown. And then my grandfather and grandmother, they liked the older blues even, you know. And then, of course, being a teenager, the blues was our language. I mean, the rhythm and blues, all those Bird quartets, the Ravens, the Orioles, you know, and all those, the Dominoes. So you grow up in a world of black music, but at the same time, you're in America. You see, so you're gonna get all of that. See what I'm saying?
Did you ever take music lessons or
constantly,
learn instruments?
Constantly, I was always taking music lessons. I did piano lessons. I didn't like. I took what else? Drumming lessons, which I didn't like, and I took trumpet lessons, which I liked. But then, at the time when I could have blossomed, I guess, into a trumpet player, I stopped playing the trumpet for some reason. When I went away to college, I stopped playing the trumpet for some reason. I don't know why, but I liked the trumpet at the time because my heroes then were trumpet players. They had, you know, I had just begun to, you know, Dizzy Gillespie, of course, was my first hero, and then Miles Davis, and they were trumpet players, you know, so I identified with them very heavily, you know.
Did your teachers, the people who you were studying with, know about jazz and rhythm and blues, or were they teaching you music you didn't much like?
Well, they would teach, you know, I had this Italian trumpet teacher. He was a great trumpet teacher, but he wanted you to play like you were playing, you know, Verdi or something like that, you know, and he gave me this Rudy Muck mouthpiece. I'd be making these C above high C, you know, pop, 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 pop. And I didn't really want to play like that. So he had fixed me up, so I had to play like that. So in order to play like Miles, I had to slide the horn around to the side of my mouth, which probably ruined my armature forever.
Did you ever wish you were a musician?
All the time, all the time. I always wanted to be a musician. When growing up, I really was drawn to the music. I think the only thing that stopped me from becoming a musician was the fact that I didn't do it, and I didn't do it because I knew there was something else I wanted to do, which was write, apparently.
We've talked a little bit about how you've gone through different stages in your life, and you've even gone through different names in your life. How do you feel about the work that you've written in earlier periods, the work, I'm thinking, that was written under your first name of Leroy Jones? Do you feel alienated from that work, or do you still feel connected to it?
No, I don't get uptight about it because I'm not him anymore. You know what I mean? I look at it try to look at it objectively. Obviously, some stuff I wish I hadn't done, some stuff I'm embarrassed by because I am Leroy Jones. But I think I tend to approach it as an artifact. I did that then. I try to understand what I was doing, why I thought what I thought, why I wrote what I wrote. And, you know, keep stepping.
Amiri Baraka speaking with Terry Gross, recorded in 1986. Baraka died yesterday at the age of 79.